I'm VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. The office of the UN Syrian envoy, Geir Pedersen, said Monday that he stressed the need for a Syria-led political transition as he met in Damascus with the head of the rebel group that led the ouster of longtime President Bashar al-Assad. In its statement, the envoy's office said the transition should be based on the principles of a 2015 UN Security Council resolution that calls for credible, inclusive, and non-sectarian governance within 6 months, as well as establishing a process for drafting a new constitution with elections to follow. Meanwhile, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas said Monday she has instructed the bloc's top diplomat for Syria to go to Damascus and make contact with the country's new government.
For us, it's not only the words, but we want to see the deeds going to the right direction. So not only what they are saying, but also what they are doing. I think the coming weeks and months will show whether it goes to the right direction. And I think then we are also open to discuss next steps.
Gaza's health ministry said Monday that Israel's offensive against Hamas militants in the Palestinian enclave has killed more than 45,000 people since it began in October of 2023. VOA's Richard Green reports.
The Gaza health ministry said in its daily update that 52 people were killed during the past day. The ministry does not distinguish between civilians and fighters in its count, but as previously said, more than half of those killed have been women and children. Israel's military said its Operation Sunday included striking a Hamas command and control complex in Nuseirat in southern Gaza. The war began in October 2023 when Hamas militants killed about 1,200 people and took another 250 hostage when it launched a surprise attack on southern Israel. About 100 hostages are still being held in Gaza, with at least one-third believed to be dead. Richard Green, VOA News.
This is VOA News. South Korea's Constitutional Court begins reviewing the impeachment of President Yoon Suk-yeol Monday over his December 3rd martial law attempt, while investigators say they plan to question him this week. Reuters correspondent Ryan Chang reports.
A spokesperson for the court said the first hearing will be held on December 27th. The court has 6 months to decide whether to remove Yoon from office or to reinstate him. Under South Korea's constitution, six justices must agree in order to oust an impeached president. The nine-member court has three vacancies, so the current justices would have to vote unanimously to remove Yoon. In South Korea's only previous presidential removal by impeachment, the court took 3 months to oust Park Geun-hye in 2017. Meanwhile, investigators from the police, defense ministry, and an anti-corruption agency also plan to question Yoon this week. On Sunday, Yoon did not appear at a summons for questioning in a separate investigation by the prosecutor's office.
That was Reuters correspondent Ryan Chang reporting. French Foreign Affairs Minister Jean-Noël Barrot said Monday his government will be working with the European Commission to ensure that European solidarity is in place to support the reconstruction effort in its poor Indian Ocean territory of Mayotte, which has been shattered by its worst storm in nearly a century. VOA's Tommy McNeil reports.
Hundreds or even thousands of people are thought to have died when Cyclone Chido hit the island on Saturday. Rescue teams, medical personnel, and tons of supplies have been sent to the island off the east coast of Africa from France and from a nearby French territory. French authorities say more than 800 more personnel are expected to arrive in the coming days as rescuers comb through the devastation. French television station TF1 reported Monday morning that the interior minister had arrived in Mayotte. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
U.S. residents hoping for lower interest rates may be disappointed after this week's meeting of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King reports.
The Fed is widely expected to reduce the benchmark interest rate, but only by a quarter point to about 4.3%. The last few economic reports indicate that inflation has dropped, but remains stubbornly above the 2% target rate. Economists in Wall Street now predict policymakers will signal fewer rate cuts in 2025 and a more gradual pace than was previously expected. David Wilcox, a former senior Fed official and an economist with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says we're on the cusp of a transition to them not cutting every meeting. Wilcox says they're going to slow the tempo of cuts. On Tuesday, the government will report the November retail sales figures, which are expected to show healthy consumer demand. I'm Jennifer King.
That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com, 24 hours a day. I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Interior Minister is visiting the island to see the emergency needed and to see what can be done. And at the same time, the airport is completely destroyed, but French helicopters and military craft have arrived with some help.
That is Abdushakur Aboud from VOA Swahili Service updating us on France's efforts to help Mayotte after a devastating cyclone ripped the French archipelago. Details coming up also. Ghana's president-elect talks about his vision for a 24-hour economy. And we get the latest in sports. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Cyclone Chido, a Category 4 storm, ripped across the French archipelago of Mayotte Saturday, inflicting devastation that one resident likened it to an atomic bomb, with hundreds and possibly even thousands of feared victims. Rescue teams and medical personnel have been sent to Mayotte off the east coast of Africa from France and from the nearby French territory of Reunion, as well as tons of supplies. French Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau today has been inspecting damage in the French overseas territory, a small island in the Indian Ocean that was shattered by its worst storm in nearly a century. Authorities in Mayotte fear hundreds and possibly thousands of people have died in Cyclone Chido, although there have been only about 14 deaths officially confirmed so far. For more on the disaster, I spoke to my colleague Abdushakur Aboud with the VOA Swahili Service, who is closely monitoring the catastrophe.
Yeah, it was a very big cyclone, according to the reports from Mayotte. They're saying that it's the first time in 100 years that such a thing happened. The whole island probably is devastated, infrastructure, houses. And, you know, a big part of that island is like a shanty town. People don't have solid houses. People live in tin houses and temporary houses, so they're all flattened. And it's not known how many people have been injured. By Monday, they didn't know how many people have died, because the mayor of the town says that it's so difficult, apart from the 320,000 Maoris who live on that island, you have at least 100,000 immigrants from Comoro and some African countries who are living in very poor, dire situation, and nobody knows the account of them. So that's where the situation is, and it's very difficult.
So what is being done right now?
Right now, the Minister of Interior from France is already on the island. As you know, Mayotte is a part of France. It's a part of France like other islands in the world. And so it's the responsibility of the French government to give help. The Interior Minister is visiting the island to see the emergency needed and to see what can be done. And at the same time, the airport is completely destroyed, but French helicopters and military craft have arrived with some help. But people are having difficulty to move around because all the roads are destroyed or debris are on the road. So work is going on and people are trying to clear the way to be sure that they can send aid, and also rescue work is underway.
So Mayotte is very close to Madagascar. Any damage to Madagascar, or it's just Mayotte by itself that has the brunt of the...
Mayotte is the one which came... Mayotte is the one which really had the brunt of the hurricane. The hurricane passed north part of Madagascar, so it didn't destroy Madagascar at all, but it has created huge destruction in Mozambique, north of Mozambique, in the states of Nampula and Cabo Delgado. They're saying 5 people have died over there. The infrastructure is destroyed. So that's what is happening right now.
That was Abdushakur Aboud with the VOA Swahili Service briefing us on the latest widespread damage in Mayotte.
Mm-hmm.
In an exclusive interview with VOA's Pauline Ndiho, Ghana's president-elect John Dramani Mahama discusses the challenges he faces in reviving the country's economy and managing the national debt to addressing the urgent issue of youth unemployment.
And so what we did was to drill down our message to issues to do with job creation and the economy, and eventually did pay off. The economy is going to be the number one focus because it affects everything else. If the economy is in a bad way, it affects education, it affects agriculture, it affects sports, it affects every sector of the country. So we're going to have to be dealing with stabilizing the economy. Unfortunately, in this circumstance, we have two major issues. One, macroeconomic stability, and two, debt sustainability. In all the other times that we've gone to the IMF, it's just been for macroeconomic stability, but we have twin problems now. And so we are going to continue the IMF program. We already have requested some discussion with the IMF because we're not part of the negotiation of this program. And so we need to look at how we can all be on the same wavelength in terms of implementing the program. We're not going to jettison the program. I want to make that clear. We're not jettisoning the program. But within the program, I'm sure that there can be some leverage for tweaking it. And so if we're able to reach that agreement, then we'll continue the program till it ends. What it means is that the budgets must align with the IMF program. So there's not much leverage in there for making the kind of radical reforms that you might immediately need to make. But we would accept the reforms that are being made under the IMF and deepen them when we have our own program after the current extended credit facility runs out. So far, so good. Bringing down inflation is number one priority. Stabilizing the currency is number two. Bringing the deficit down, cutting expenditure, increasing revenues. I mean, those are the things that we need to be looking at.
One of the things that resonated with the young people was the 24-hour economy.
Yes.
Do you care explaining what that means for ordinary Ghanaians?
Yeah. 24-hour economy is not a new thing. It's being implemented in many countries. And so Ghana will not be the first to implement a 24-hour economy. What a 24-hour economy does is that you provide incentives to the private sector to be able to increase their production and increase the number of working hours and increase the number of employees. That is what it is. And so it's purely an incentive-based program where you say, look, if you increase your production, you increase your number of employees, you increase your number of working hours, government will give you these incentives. It could include tax measures. It could include lower costs in terms of utilities and so on and so forth. So there are many other things that we could do. So immediately what we're doing is to set up a committee that will begin to flesh out the policy, because it's in our 120-day plan that within the 120 days we'll come out with a clear-cut policy on the 24-hour economy policy. So we have to hit the ground running.
That was Ghana's president-elect John Dramani Mahama speaking with my colleague Pauline Ndiho. Political analysts in Ghana say voter frustration contributed to Mahama's victory in the country's presidential election on December 7th. You can see more of this interview on voaafrica.com, YouTube, and Facebook. Ghana is facing a wave of harmful disinformation and misinformation. Some journalists are hoping to fight back with accurate reporting. As part of our series on disinformation in Africa, reporter Isaac Kaldezi has more from Accra, Ghana.
Kweku Asante leads a team of journalists at Fact Check Ghana, a project by the Media Foundation for West Africa based in the capital Accra. The team has the daunting task of fighting disinformation and misinformation in social media and in traditional media. Asante says he and his colleagues have no shortage of material to work on.
There's a lot of disinformation out there. You wake up in the morning and you see a lot of mentions and tag. Could you look into this for us? Is this accurate information? Is it really the case? Anybody here to help us? And then we come in here and say, well, we have verified it. This is what is the truth. This is not accurate. So this is the accurate information.
Fact-checking is Asante's passion. And for the past 5 years, he has worked to empower Ghanaians with accurate information.
It gives me a lot of joy, you know, knowing that you are doing something that directly connects to bringing impact and direct influence on the people, because false information can have very dire impact. Look at COVID-19 when there was an influx of false information.
University student Portia Fafale Geja knows firsthand about the impact false information can have. She almost got duped after receiving false information on WhatsApp about Ghana's vice president, Mahamadou Bawumia, giving out free cash.
So someone sent a link to me that Bawumia was giving out free money. So I just clicked on the link, did all the process, and it got to a point where I had to share on WhatsApp. I was sharing. At the end of the day, I never got the money. So it was there that I realized that someone came to tell me that these news are fake, so I shouldn't just follow them. Because imagine the time I was using to share those links. I could have done something. And at that way, I was using my data, and I was sharing something that was very fake. I felt embarrassed.
Asante and his team deploy several digital tools to verify information. The Invid Fake Debunker is one of them, helping to authenticate the source of any video that is published online. Santi says more verification tools are available to help.
When it comes to videos, Invid Fake Debunker has always helped us in terms of pulling the frames from photos to help us do searches on videos. There's a new platform that's popped that GeoSpy combines both the Google platform for photos and geolocation, you know, merged. Also really helps us.
Asante is not alone in this fight. Rabiu Al-Hassan has been a practicing journalist for more than 10 years now. He's the team lead at Fact Space West Africa, a fact-checking organization working to tackle misinformation and disinformation, as well as propaganda across West Africa. Ghana Fact is part of this organization. Al-Hassan says for him, fighting misinformation is more than just a job. He knows the harm that bad news can do to ordinary people, nations, and the entire West African region.
We are not too far off from having bad actors pay attention to what is happening in the country, identify the major fault lines, and try to exploit that. The reason why we are trying in our own small ways to make impact by helping newsrooms in setting up their fact-check index, by helping journalists be equipped with more skill set to be able to identify misinformation and tackle disinformation campaigns.
Al-Hassan and his team rely on several digital tools to support their work. Prominent among them is reverse image search on some images that circulate on social media. He is optimistic that fact-checking can keep pace with misinformation. Isaac Kalaji, VOA Africa, Accra, Ghana.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yehia Suhib, in Washington. Niger's defense ministry says suspected Islamic militants killed 39 civilians, including women and children, in two separate attacks in western Niger's conflict-torn borderlands in recent days. Reuters News reports the attackers struck the communities of Kokuru and Libri, though the government did not give further details on the date of the bloodshed. Niger and its neighbors in West Africa's Sahel region, Mali and Burkina Faso, are on the front lines of the battle to contain an insurgent threat that has steadily grown since 2012, when Al-Qaeda-linked fighters first seized parts of Mali. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated Brendan Carr to lead the Federal Communications Commission, which regulates communications in the United States. Carr, an FCC commissioner since 2017, has taken aim at big tech
and China's influence on U.S. communications. VOA's Dora McQuar reports.
Brendan Carr is President-elect Donald Trump's choice to lead the Federal Communications Commission. The agency regulates TV and radio broadcasters, telephone and internet providers, and satellites. Carr is currently a sitting FCC commissioner and longtime staffer. Stephen McDowell is a professor in the School of Communication at Florida State University.
What's clear is he has a lot of experience. I believe he's been there since 2012 as an attorney. And he's also been pretty transparent, which is good. He both has a pretty good sense of, or very strong sense of how the FCC works and how things get done there.
Trump describes the 45-year-old attorney as, quote, a warrior for free speech. Carr wrote about the FCC in the conservative policy priority handbook, Project 2025, saying that social media companies suppress certain political views. And he says he wants to police TV networks for bias. Carr spoke with Fox News in late November after being tapped to head the FCC.
Americans have lived under an unprecedented surge in censorship over the last couple of years, and we have to work together to smash the censorship cartel. Number two is media. Trust in media is at an all-time low, and there's a lot the FCC can do there to make sure that broadcasters are, in fact, serving the public interest.
Those efforts are being criticized as potential infringements of the Constitution's First Amendment right to free speech. Jessica J. Gonzalez is co-CEO of Free Press, a media advocacy organization.
One of the things that he proposes to do is actually force those private companies to leave up content that advertisers and others find offensive. So, in other words, using the power of the federal government to force certain kinds of speech to be hosted by private companies.
Carr also wants to get internet access to more Americans. And he's expressed national security concerns around China-made technology and equipment providers, as well as the Chinese-owned social media platform TikTok, for possibly gathering information about Americans on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP. Again, here's Carr speaking with Fox News.
The CCP doesn't come at the U.S. and our freedoms through any one particular vector. They come through all sorts of devices. They come through all sorts of services. That's why it's important that we be vigilant.
Those national security concerns are less likely to be controversial for the five-member bipartisan panel that Carr will lead. Again, here's Carr speaking with Fox News.
There's already some funding in place to what they call rip and replace, to pull out some network equipment that's in place already and replace it with what's considered to be safer.
Shortly after Trump designated Carr to lead the FCC, Carr announced that the agency will end its diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he will visit Ethiopia and Somalia early next year after brokering a deal to end tensions between the two Horn of Africa neighbors. On December 11th, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud agreed to end their nearly year-long dispute. The dispute began in January when landlocked Ethiopia struck a deal in which Somalia's breakaway region Somaliland to lease a stretch of coastline for a port and military base. In return, Somaliland, which declared independence from Somalia in 1991 in a move not recognized by Mogadishu or other governments, said Ethiopia would give it formal recognition, although this was never confirmed by Addis Ababa. Somalia branded the deal a violation of its sovereignty, setting international alarm bells ringing over the risk of renewed conflict in the volatile Horn of Africa region. The African Union, United States, and other world leaders hailed the outcome of the talks in Turkey. And time now for our sports roundup. I have our VOA sports analyst, Mokbil Yabaro, in studio. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehiz.
So, in the world of football, Manchester City has been struggling, and the team played in a derby against Manchester United on Sunday. What happened?
Yes. What happened? What a question. Way to pose it. Manchester City leads the game almost all the way until the very end. Some brilliant play by the Manchester United player, Amad Diallo, for being able to get himself into a vulnerable position, getting a penalty kick late. Manchester United is able to level it at 1-1 with only a few minutes left in the game, and then one more opportunity. So they go from being 1-0 down to being able to score two goals, 2-1 victory in maybe under 10 minutes of the game left. Pep Guardiola and the Manchester City Football Club, this is a team that has been revered for so long. Treble winners just two years ago. They've done everything to win at the top of the game this year after having lost their key player, Rodri, the Ballon d'Or winner. He goes down with an ACL tear, season-ending injury. And then it just seems like after that, they've just been rolling down this hill. And we don't know how long this hill is going, Yehez, because they are going down and down and down. At the moment, they are currently sitting in fifth position with 27 points. But us knowing Manchester City, we know that this is a team that, for whatever reason, they can be down and they can seem like they're out, but they're not always fully out. So you still got to be careful and mindful. They might pick up some steam potentially because we know they have the capability to do so, but they're looking really bad, in a funk. Last 11 games, no wins.
So that is what...
I should say one win in the last 11 games.
So that is what happened.
Yes, sir.
So, staying with football, the Premier League is shaping up to be really tight this year. What games impact the top of the table?
Yeah, if we're going to look at, I would say the first game that we would have to talk about would have to be Liverpool versus Fulham. Liverpool at the top currently with 36 points with a game in hand, meaning that if they win that game, they will be at 39 points. They'll be leading second place Chelsea by 5 points, but Chelsea was able to get that gap to be a little bit closer. I believe it was a 7-point gap for them, but because they were able to win and Liverpool drew and only accumulated 1 point, they've tightened that lead. So Liverpool had a 2-2 draw against Fulham. Fulham's been playing well. They also drew with Arsenal last week as well. They are currently sitting at the eighth position. This is a team that normally sits a little bit lower down, about 12th, 13th position. But this year, they're really making a push, looking like if they finish at that eighth spot, they will be able to play in European football this year. So big win for them. I mean, it wasn't a win, but it was to get points off of the leaders is huge. But also, Liverpool was playing with 10 men for almost 70 minutes. So them coming away with some points is also good for them as well. Chelsea, 2-1 win against Brentford, just keeps that machine going. This is a team that just last year were barely able to break top 10 with their new manager Maresca coming in. During the summer break, they had 40 players on this roster. He dropped a ton of them. Now this team is at about 20, 21 players, really high-level players, young guys. They haven't really had as much injuries as everybody else at the top as well, so it's been really good for them. They've been on a 12-game win streak, no losses. I believe 2 draws in that, 10 wins. They're really on a roll. And then Arsenal, unfortunate result against Everton. Everton is in the 16th spot currently, not being able to get a win at home against a struggling team really knocks them down to that third spot. Now, currently, they're at 30 points. They are 6 points behind the leaders, Liverpool, but with a potential 9 if Liverpool win their game at hand. So 9 points from the top. It's not a great spot to be in. Still a long season, so we'll see how that goes.
And the NBA Emirates Cup Finals will be on Tuesday in Las Vegas. Who will clash for the cup?
Yes. And we spoke about this. Interestingly enough, my guess kind of came true a little bit. So as I mentioned, I thought the Thunder and the Milwaukee Bucks would be clashing. They both were able to beat their opponents in the semifinals. The Bucks were able to beat the Hawks 110-102. And the Thunder were able to beat the Rockets 111-96. Currently, the Thunder versus the Milwaukee Bucks. This will be a clash of two of the premier teams in the league. So we'll see how it goes.
Mokbilia Baro, our sports analyst, thanks for your input. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Hunley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.